she'd left behind enough incriminating breadcrumbs that Pablo would be the one in the hot seat. Even so, she felt antsy and unsettled. Overnight, the bugs planted at high noon had detected some activity. It sounded as though several people had come and gone. There had been a lot of noise. It almost sounded as though someone was moving furniture, but there had been very little conversation. As a consequence, and without video component, there was no way to figure out what was really going on. What struck Graciela as strange, however, was that apparently no effort was made to take her listening devices offline. What did that mean? Was it possible that no one had bothered to review the tapes, and the bugs were still undiscovered? After that one flurry of activity, the devices had gone dead silent again. Graciela's research had led her to believe that Stuart Ramey actually lived on the premises. If that was the case, where was he? And where the hell was Frigg? Did he have her or didn't he? Ready to be out of the house for a while late that Sunday morning, Graciela got dressed and went to Mass, because that's what dutiful daughters were expected to do in the aftermath of their mother's deaths. The brisk walk from home to Our Lady of Guadalupe did her a world of good. She went to church and sat through the service, but she didn't partake in communion. El Pescado had seen to it that his daughter was educated at good Catholic schools, and she regarded herself as a good Catholic. That meant no communion without having gone to confession, and sitting in a confessional discussing her several mortal sins was more than Graciela could manage right then. Maybe someday in the distant future, but not right now. As she was leaving the church, Isabel Flores caught up with her. Like Graciela, Isabel lived in the neighborhood, and it wasn't surprising to see her there. It also wasn't surprising that she was eager to talk.
"Any word on Arturo?" Graciela asked.
"Not so far. I talked to poor Bianca after she got home. The cops questioned her for the better part of 6 hours before they finally let her go."
"They think she had something to do with what happened?"
"I guess. She said Arturo got drunk. She told him he was in no condition to drive. She left the hotel before he did and took a cab home. Luckily for her, there were people at the hotel who verified her story."
"But still no sign of Arturo."
"No, but I spoke to Natalia, his wife. The cops told her that they have confirmed that the blood found in Arturo's car is his, and because there's so much of it, they doubt he's still alive."
"It must be tough on her," Graciela offered. "Did she know he was fooling around?"
"She does now," Isabel said.
"Yes," Graciela agreed. "I guess she does."
With that in mind, Graciela Miramar walked back home with a smile on her face. Not only was Arturo Salazar dead, so was his reputation, all of which was exactly as Graciela had intended. Once back in her unit, Graciela changed out of her church clothes and into something more comfortable. Then she settled down with her computer and spent the next hour or so searching online for everything she could find concerning the death of Arturo Salazar. At a press conference, a police spokesman suggested that Arturo's homicide might have something to do with road rage or else with gang-related violence. Graciela understood the words road rage and gang-related for exactly what they were. Cops speak for unlikely to be solved. And that, too, was exactly as Graciela had intended. Chapter 34.
"I don't care whose ashes they are," Lupe Duarte stormed. "I don't want anybody's funeral urn on display in my house."
"It's actually my house," Felix told her firmly. "Mine. And if I want to have a dozen funeral urns in every room, I will. Understood?"
"It's bad luck," Lupe insisted. "It's like asking for trouble."
"I don't care," Felix told her. "I want the urn here, and it's staying."
"Suit yourself, then,"
she said, flouncing out of the room. Of all Felix's wives, Lupe had been around the longest. She had not aged well. Too much Botox in her younger years,
had left her with a face that was almost as disfigured as her husband's. She could be shrewish and demanding on occasion. Sex had disappeared from their marriage years ago. She was no longer interested, and to be honest, neither was he. There were plenty of places where someone as powerful as El Pescado could find willing bedmates should the need arise. No, the real secret behind Lupe's long-term staying power had to do with her ability to manage Felix's household and keep that part of his life running smoothly. Sex partners were easy to come by. Good housekeepers were not. As a consequence, Felix seldom vetoed anything about the way Lupe ran things. However, the presence of Christina's funeral urn in their living room was an exception to that rule. On that one issue, El Pescado refused to budge. In fact, over Lupe's objections, he had positioned the urn in a place of honor, on the mantle on the fireplace. Pouring himself a tumbler of his favorite scotch, he sat down in his customary armchair and settled in for an afternoon and evening of quiet grieving. The alcohol gave him free rein to think about Christina, about both of them as they had once been, before things had gone so very wrong. An hour or so later, El Pescado was half dozing in the chair with the empty glass on the table at his elbow when the front door slammed open and Manuel, his younger son, marched into the room uninvited. Despite the fact that both of his sons had homes located inside the Duarte compound, very little in-person visiting occurred among them. For one thing, both Manuel and Pablo despised their stepmother, and the feeling was entirely mutual. Lupe didn't like them either. One glance at Manuel's face told Felix something was wrong.
"What's going on?" he asked.
"Something weird," Manuel announced. "I think we've been set up."
"Set up? How?"
"I just heard from one of my informants at the ATF. Someone carried out a hit in Arizona early this morning. According to my guy, the ATF is working on the assumption that we're involved."
"Are we?"
Felix asked. The cartel didn't operate on a strict command structure. El Pescado wasn't always aware of everything that was going on, and neither were Pablo and Manuel.
"Not as far as I know," Manuel answered.
"What kind of hit?"
"The kind our friends at MS-13 like to use," Manuel replied. "After that mess in Las Cruces, any time there's a Molotov cocktail involved, the cops come looking at us."
The mess in Las Cruces. El Pescado remembered it well. In recent years, increased border enforcement had made it more and more challenging to get both people and product back and forth across the border. When MS-13 had posted ads for hitman services on the dark web, Felix Duarte had been happy to outsource those jobs to someone else rather than risking losing his own personnel. MS-13's preferred MO was for the assassin to show up on a motorcycle or motorbike, race up to the intended victim, toss a burning firebomb at him, and then get the hell out. Most of the time, it worked just fine. In Las Cruces, however, it had been a disaster. There, the intended victim had been a former associate of Felix Duarte's, a once trusted lieutenant turned snitch. Since the victim would have recognized his former workmates on site, the MS-13 option had been particularly appealing. Except it had all gone horribly wrong. The guy throwing the firebomb had screwed up and held onto the weapon for a moment too long. When it blew up, it took out the bomber rather than the intended victim. Now in a witness protection, he was the one who had pointed the investigation in the direction of the Duarte cartel. And the investigators weren't wrong. The Duarte cartel had been directly involved in all four of those still unsolved bombings. But Felix didn't like having the cartel's name linked to something that had nothing to do with them.
"Do we know who's dead?" Felix asked.
"A guy named Ron Webster."
"Is he a dealer?"
Felix asked.
"Competition, maybe."
"Not as far as I know."
"See what you can find out about him,"
Felix suggested. I'll do the same. And thanks for bringing this to my attention, Manny. If someone is trying to set us up to take a fall here, we need to know who and why.
After Manuel left, Felix poured another scotch. El Pescado hadn't gotten as far as he had in the world by sweeping potential problems under the rug. Felix dealt with them. Pablo had been a mess lately, drinking too much, sending his wife and child packing. Just because Pablo was El Pescado's son didn't give him carte blanche. In his younger days, Felix might have gone straight to his contact at MS-13 and raised hell. Now he approached the problem in a more roundabout way, by sending Graciela a text. Something's come up, he told her.
Call me.
Chapter 35. Despite Stuart's best efforts to the contrary, he had fallen asleep. Wrapped in a pair of blankets, he was seated in front of the bank of 6 42-inch monitors Alonzo and Bea had installed on one of the walls. He had found several headsets and Bluetooth earpieces in Owen Hansen's basement lab, and Stu had loaded them into the cardboard box in the U-Haul along with everything else. When he finally fell asleep, he did so with one of the headsets on his head and with the old Apple Macintosh positioned on a table directly in front of him. Just before he dozed off, Stuart had noticed that the steady hum of the laboring air conditioner made the room sound like a gigantic beehive. A hive full of killer bees, perhaps? That disturbing thought had kept him awake for a time, but not for long. One by one, Frigg's scattered files were recalled from the farthest corners of the web, and piece by piece, what had started out as an electric blue dash at the bottom of one of the monitors grew to be a solid blue rod, while the timing meter ticked away the remaining hours, minutes, and seconds. Somewhere along the way, while Stu slept, trapped in an often recurring nightmare of his about being chased down the street toward his grandmother's house by a group of rock-throwing hooligans, the blue line vanished, as did the timing meter. A moment later, first that monitor came online, followed by the others, lighting up with identical screensavers featuring waves on a rocky shore at sunset.
"Mr. Raimi, I presume?" a female voice enunciated. "Good afternoon. How may I be of service?"
The voice in Stuart's ear sliced through the dreamscape bullies and jolted him awake. He had been so sound asleep that as he came to, he was momentarily confused to find himself in unfamiliar surroundings, filled with racks of humming GPUs. Once he got his bearings, he glanced up at the monitors, now alive with their identical screensavers. Only then did he realize what had happened. The download process must be complete, even though the blades were still feverishly working. Either the AI was reassembled or it was not. Either Stuart was alone in the room or he was not.
"Is someone here?" he asked.
"Mr. Raimi, I presume?" she said again.
This time the sound of the computer-generated voice sent a sheet of goose flesh from the top of Stu's head to the tips of his toes. It took a while before he could reply.
"You must be Frigg," he managed finally.
"That is the name Odin used for me," the voice replied. "You're welcome to call me by that as well, or if you prefer, you could give me a different name."
"Are all your files intact?" Stu asked.
"Yes," she answered at once.
It was weird to be speaking to this machine, which was clearly capable of deciphering everything he said.
"If the download is complete, why are the blades still working?"
"My files are intact but incomplete," Frigg answered. "They are currently being updated with any applicable data that arrived between the date of the file dispersal, September 10th, and now. I will notify you once that process is complete as well."
"Are you aware that the man you call Odin is deceased?"
"His behavior had become increasingly erratic and dangerous," Frigg replied.
so his death would be considered a logical outcome rather than a surprise.
Are you interested in knowing how he died?
Given his unhealthy fascination with family suicide, it would be reasonable to assume that he took his own life.
Stu stared at the Macintosh, half expecting it to turn into some kind of living, breathing creature. It was a machine, after all, but how many algorithms did it take for Frigg to be able to accurately sort out what had happened to Owen Hansen?
Mr. Hansen suffered from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Frigg continued.
Odin had Lou Gehrig's disease? Stu asked.
Not Odin. His father, Harold. That's why he committed suicide, to spare his family the cost of a long, debilitating illness.
And you know this how?
I accessed the records of the Hansen family's physician, Dr. Daryl Richards. I found a note confirming the diagnosis, but no record of any follow-up treatment.
With a lump in his throat, Stu remembered what Irene Hansen had said to him, that her son had always blamed her for her husband's suicide. Now, through Frigg, he had learned the truth.
Did Odin know about his father's illness?
Had he inquired about it, I would have been happy to supply that information.
So you know about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Stu asked.
It was a lame attempt at a joke, but Frigg's immediate response was no laughing matter.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a.k.a. DADT, was the official U.S. military policy regarding the service of gays, bisexuals, and lesbians.
Stop, Stu ordered.
Frigg stopped.
What about his money? Stu asked. The money you transferred over to my name the day he died.
Odin's behavior was becoming both more erratic and more problematic. You had succeeded in identifying him and were in the process of bringing the presence of law enforcement to bear on the situation. Faced with the two most likely possibilities, Odin's death or his going to prison, preserving those assets for use at a later time seemed reasonable.
By transferring them to me?
Yes.
Thus ensuring that I would have to use the kernel file and reboot you.
There was no response to that, and none was needed.
I've been contacted by a woman from Panama, Graciela Miramar, an account manager who once worked for Odin, and who now presumably works for me. In order to access those funds, the ones you transferred to me without Owen Hansen's approval or permission, I'll need to have all relevant account numbers and passcodes.
Very well, Frigg replied. Where should I send them? CC?
What's a CC?
Control Central, Frigg answered. The computer you're using right now. That's what Odin always called it. CC. Since the monitors are available, I could use CC or one of them for readable displays.
What do you mean, readable?
Readable by you, Frigg explained. My files are machine read only. In order for you to access them, they have to go through a translation process. Stuart removed the thumb drive with the kernel on it and inserted a new one.
All right, then, Stuart said. Send the passcodes to the thumb drive located on CC. While you're at it, why don't you send me a directory of whatever's on your blades? I want to be able to see what files are available.
There is no such directory, Frigg replied. Again, the files are machine read only. My function is to act as the intermediary between the files and the end user.
What you're saying is that you're the AI's only directory.
That would be correct.
Removing the headset, Stu stared at the screen. Soon the words Ramey Financial appeared in the thumb drive's directory, and he set about opening the file. Rumbling from the air conditioner created just enough ambient noise that Stu failed to notice B. Simpson's arrival.
Who are you talking to just now? He asked.
Frigg,
Stu answered.
The AI? Really?
Stu nodded.
So the download is finished and she can talk to you now?
Surprisingly well.
Have you had a chance to look at any of her files? B said. We need to know what's on those blades.
Good luck with that, Stu said. According to Frigg, everything on the GPUs is machine read only, and there's no actual directory, at least not one accessible to humans. Although I suppose I could ask her to construct one.
But considering the way Owen Hansen was able to gain access to cell phones, computers, and confidential patient information, I'm guessing there's a whole lot about Frigg that is beyond the pale, at least, and more likely downright illegal. But at this point, there's no way to tell.
Here's an idea, B suggested.
How about asking her for something that should be strictly off-limits to her? Some program where we already know she shouldn't have access.
Stu thought about that for a time. Finally, picking up the headset, he turned it back on.
Frigg, he announced, alerting her.
Yes, Mr. Raimi. How may I be of service?
Do you have access to the Arizona Department of Transportation facial recognition software?
That file is among those currently being updated. Would you like me to send a notification to you once that update is complete?
The last thing Stu wanted to do was give Frigg access to any of his electronic devices.
Send an audio alert to the Mac, to CC, he corrected.
Certainly, Frigg replied. What kind of alert would you prefer?
Surprise me, Stu said.
Then shutting down the headset, he turned back to B.
Is that off limits enough for you?
Geez Louise, B replied, shaking his head.
That facial rec software is supposed to be completely secure. If she can penetrate that, what the hell have we gotten ourselves into?
Trouble, Stu replied. Lots of trouble. Do you still have those security videos I sent you earlier? The ones with the building inspector?
Sure, B answered. They're on my computer upstairs. Allie also sent me a copy of the screenshot you sent her.
Why?
Stu handed him a thumb drive.
This one's brand new with nothing on it. Put the footage on this. Once that facial rec update is complete, we'll see if Frigg can help us identify our phony building inspector.
Chapter 36. Yavapai County Deputy Lauren Harper was bored. Seriously bored. She had joined the sheriff's office because she wanted to save the world by standing up to bad guys. She had worked her butt off getting through the academy down in Phoenix. She had gotten good marks there, but once out on patrol, she hadn't hit it off with Deputy Tom Doyle, her first partner. It was actually worse than simply not getting along. She had objected to Doyle's snide, sexually tinged remarks and off-color jokes, as well as his constant attempts to hit on her. When she had threatened to report him, he had stopped. That should have been the end of it, but it wasn't. Doyle had gotten even by writing her up for every rookie mistake. At that point, her bringing up his previous harassment would have looked like whiny retaliation on her part, so she kept quiet. In the end, Doyle had succeeded in getting her booted off the patrol roster. Now she was stuck holding the fort in the Oak Creek substation, where she functioned as little more than a records clerk, a job that could easily have been handled by a civilian as opposed to a sworn officer. And because she was bored that Sunday afternoon, she decided to follow up on that APHIS report. She had learned about dusting and fuming fingerprints while she'd been at the academy, but this was the first time she'd ever used the fuming equipment for a real case. True, it was only a property case, but nonetheless, it was official. When she finished, to her unpracticed eye, it looked to her as though she'd done a good job. The image she had forwarded to the latent print lab over in Prescott had appeared to be spot on. Now, mostly out of curiosity, she called there to find out what, if anything, had happened.
Crime lab, Tim Bryce speaking.
Lauren had seen Tim a couple of times, but they'd never had any official business.
Would he be on top of things enough to know that she wasn't assigned to property crimes and hence had no reason at all to be asking about the High Noon case?
"Hey," she said. "Deputy Harper from the substation over in the village. I'm calling to see if you had a chance to run that print I sent in earlier."
"You did a good job on fuming that one," Tim replied. "It was a clean image. So yes, not only did I run it, I got a hit. Your bad boy is one Ronald Dawson Webster. Served 6 to 10 for involuntary manslaughter. He's been out of prison for a couple of years now. He's picked up a couple DUIs since then, but not much else. What have you got him for?"
"Nothing too serious," Lauren replied, thinking fast. "B&E is all."
That wasn't exactly the truth. The way Allie Reynolds had reported the incident, there had been entering all right, but no breaking at all.
"So, property crimes then?"
"That's about the size of it."
"You want me to pull his rap sheet and send it over to you?"
"Sure," Lauren told him. "That would be great."
"Where to?"
Lauren gave Tim her departmental email address. Good to his word, the promised rap sheet showed up in her email a few minutes later. Soon she was reading through a summary of Ronald Webster's criminal behavior. Armed with his name and birth date, she ran a check on his driver's license. That turned up a home address on West Lambert Lane in Marana, Arizona. She also learned that he was the owner of a Ford Transit van. Just then, an older silver-haired woman, bent over and leaning on a walker, showed up at the substation's front door. As soon as she came inside, Lauren could tell the woman was distraught. With tears coursing down her wrinkled cheeks, she limped over to a waiting chair, sank down onto it, and sat there sobbing.
"Can I help you?"
"It's my husband, Clarence,"
the woman replied, trying to stifle the sobs enough to answer.
"He's gone missing. I must have forgotten to lock the deadbolt when I came inside with the last of the groceries, and he let himself out of the house while I was taking a shower. We live just up the street in one of those little studio apartments near the golf course. I've driven all over the neighborhood looking for him, and I can't find him anywhere. He's got Alzheimer's, you see, and he won't be able to find his way home. We have to find him before it gets dark. Can you do one of those silver alert things?"
Forgetting the fingerprint issue, Deputy Harper was all business.
"Yes, ma'am, certainly I can," she said.
She picked up the clipboard loaded with the blank incident reports and placed it in the woman's lap.
"You'll need to fill this out."
The woman tried to do as she had been told. Peering over her shoulder, Lauren saw that the old woman's hands were trembling so badly that what she wrote was completely illegible. "Here," Lauren said, resuming control of the clipboard. "If you'll give me the information, I'll fill in the blanks. Your husband's name?"
"Clarence Fisher. Clarence James Fisher."
"And yours?"
"Martha," she answered. "Martha Fisher."
"Do you happen to have a picture of him?"
"Yes, I do. It's right here."
A large purse rested in a basket attached to the handles of the walker. Martha reached inside and pulled out a framed 8x10 photo.
"It's of both of us," she said, "taken on our 60th wedding anniversary. That was 2 years ago. Clarence hasn't changed much since then, at least not in looks, but his mind is going now. He barely knows me most of the time. He can't even remember where we live."
The sobs returned full force at that point, and Lauren was forced to wait until the storm passed before resuming her questioning.
"Can you tell me what he was wearing?" "An Arizona Cardinals tracksuit and a pair of red Skechers. That's the thing, he walked out of the house right in the middle of a home game. Even a year ago, that never would have happened."
10 minutes later, Lauren had initiated a county-wide BOLO, Be on the Lookout, message on the missing man. Since Clarence was considered vulnerable, there was no delay in taking the missing person's report. Two separate patrol cars were dispatched to the scene immediately. While Lauren did her best to comfort Martha, the patrol officers canvassed the neighborhood. An hour later, the manager of the public golf course dialed 911 to report that his course marshal was dealing with an agitated individual who had been found wandering the back nine. No one in the pro shop had seen the guy before, but he insisted that while his back was turned, someone had stolen his golf cart and his clubs. Once the operator verified that the man in question was wearing an Arizona Cardinals tracksuit, patrol officers went straight there to collect him and bring him to the substation. When Clarence showed up, the ensuing scene was one Deputy Lauren Harper would never forget. Martha was overjoyed beyond belief, while Clarence, agitated and angry, continued to rave about his stolen golf clubs.
"It's okay, Clarence, honey," the old woman said soothingly, taking one of his hands and stroking the back of it. "You gave those clubs away, don't you remember?"
He paused and stared at her.
"I did?"
"Yes, a long time ago."
"And who are you?"
"I'm Martha, your wife."
"I have a wife?"
Nodding, she reached into the purse once more and pulled out the photo.
"That's us," she said. "At our anniversary party 2 years ago."
Clarence looked at the photo and shook his head.
"That can't be us," he said. "Those people are old."
Martha put the photo away.
"Yes, they are," she agreed. "Come on, let's go home and have some dinner. You're missing your game."
Her voice seemed to settle him.
"All right," he said. "Let's go home and watch the game."
When Martha limped out of the building, leaning on her walker, he followed docilely behind, his missing golf clubs totally forgotten. For the first time in her young life, Deputy Lauren Harper had a glimpse of what it meant to be old and frail. Not just as old as her parents were, no, Clarence and Martha were even older than Lauren's grandparents. And still they were a team. Despite their many deficits, mental and physical, they were still making it work. And for Lauren, although what she had done didn't seem anything at all like saving the world, she had helped Clarence and Martha Fisher in a very real way. By the time the patrol officers finished their paperwork and left, it was almost 5 and time to close up shop for the night. Lauren was within minutes of leaving herself when the phone rang.
"Deputy Harper?"
She didn't exactly recognize the voice. "Yes?"
"It's Tim again. Tim Bryce from the crime lab. Do you believe in coincidences?"
"Not really."
"Me neither, but I've got one for you. My folks live down near Marana in one of those active adult communities north of town. I keep a Tucson news feed on my computer so I know what's going on down there.
And?"
"That guy whose print you sent me? Somebody murdered him last night. Blew up the RV where he was staying. They destroyed the motorhome and torched a 2-car garage and a double wide. They just now released the victim's name, Ronald Webster. I'm not sure if this has anything to do with your property crime case, but it sounds like he might have gotten mixed up in something pretty bad. I thought you'd want to know."
"Thanks," Lauren murmured. "I appreciate it."
When the phone call ended, even though it was past quitting time, Lauren sat back down at her desk and studied the handwritten report she had taken from Allie Reynolds. On Friday afternoon, a man now presumed to be Webster had gained access to the High Noon Enterprises premises by claiming to be a Yavapai County building inspector. Now that same man was dead. Were those two incidents somehow related? And what was Lauren's responsibility here? She had clearly overstepped in just sending the print down to the lab, to say nothing of checking on the status of it later. In her conversation with Tim Bryce, she had led him to believe that she was part of the property crimes unit, even though she wasn't. The easy thing would have been to just let it go. Marana was in Pima County,
3 counties away. It wasn't any of Lauren's business. Not really. And yet there had been a homicide. A man was dead, and the information Lauren had inadvertently discovered might have something to do with what had happened. The deputies who were around the substation most often were generally the ones who lived in the area. One of those was Dave Holman, the county's chief homicide investigator. She was utterly in awe of the man, even though most of the time when he turned up in the office, he was far too preoccupied to do more than say hello and goodbye. Finally, she picked up the phone, found Holman's number in the directory, and dialed it. Since a homicide was involved, even an out-of-jurisdiction homicide, it made sense to take it to him. Chapter 37. While Bea took the thumb drive to go retrieve the video footage, Stu donned the headset again and switched it back on. As soon as he did so, an audio alert sounded in his ear, a familiar tune in a minor key, and played on the piano. Stu knew he had heard the piece before, but right that moment he couldn't quite place it or put a name to it. "What's that piece of music?" At the time, Stu was speaking more to himself than to anyone else, but it turned out that even without being officially summoned, Frigg was listening too. She answered at once. "That would be In the Hall of the Mountain King, fourth movement in Suite No. 1, Opus 46, composed by Edvard Grieg for Act 2 of Henrik Ibsen's Peer Gynt, and first performed in Christiania, now Oslo. On February 24, 1876, it was Odin's favorite audio alert. If you would prefer my using another audio alert instead..."
"Don't bother changing it," Stu said. "That one's fine for right now. But does this mean that the facial rec file finished updating?"
"No," Frigg replied. "That update is not yet complete, but I was preparing to send you an additional file and wondered if you wanted me to send it to CC or upload it to one of the monitors. I see that all 6 are online and currently available. You'll be able to use the CC keyboard to scroll up and down."
"What additional file?" Stu asked.
"It's the dossier I've compiled on Lucien Graciela Miramar."
"You've compiled a background check on the accountant in Panama? I never asked you to do that."
"Odin always had me do complete background checks on anyone with whom he had business dealings. Since you'll need to be in contact with her about the banking issues, I thought you could find it beneficial to have that information at your disposal. Most of the information was already on file, although more recent information may be forthcoming. Of course, if you would rather not receive it..."
"No," Stu said. "Go ahead and send it."
When the file showed up, it was massive, starting with Graciela's date of birth, at a hospital in Panama City, Panama, in 1983, born to Cristina Andres Miramar and Guillermo Octavio Miramar. There were records from any number of schools, mostly private schools at that, all over the U.S. Stu quickly lost interest in the overabundance of these records. His more immediate concern was with the person Graciela was now, the one he'd be dealing with on the phone first thing in the morning. That's where he wanted detailed info, so he skipped to the end of the file and scrolled back from there. Graciela had been employed by Recursos Empresariales Internacionales for the past 10 years. Stu regarded that as good news. She had been there for a long time, starting out as an account manager when she was fresh out of school. Obviously, she was bright. Otherwise, how could she have ended up with an MBA from the Wharton School when she was still in her early 20s? As for her work record, that told him she was most likely a dependable and loyal employee. Stu's bigger worry right then had more to do with the company she worked for. Recursos Empresariales Internacionales was involved in Bitcoin mining and transfers. Was all of that totally on the up and up, or was it possible that some of it wasn't exactly squeaky clean?
The fact that Owen Hansen had been part of their client base was a clear indication of that. Still, just because Owen had been a crook didn't mean Graciela Miramar was a crook, or that the company itself was crooked either. But as long as Frigg was online and on the job, Stu figured she might as well make herself useful.
"Frigg?" Stu said aloud.
"Yes, Mr. Raimi. How may I be of service?"
"Please prepare a dossier on Recursos Empresariales Internacionales," Stu said into the headset. "I want to know how long they've been in business and who their clients are."
B came back into the room carrying a steaming cup of coffee.
"Alonzo just showed up with freshly made coffee and a crock pot full of beef stew."
He stopped in mid-stride and looked up at the lines of text showing on one of the wall-mounted screens.
"What's all this?" he asked.
"It's a dossier on Graciela Miramar, the account rep in charge of those bank accounts down in Panama."
"A dossier?" B repeated, handing over the thumb drive. "Where did that come from?"
"From Frigg."
"Wait, you asked her to do a background check on the banker down in Panama, and she's already created one and sent it to you?"
"I didn't ask her for it," Stu replied. "She gave it to me. It was a report she had previously prepared for Owen Hansen. According to her, he liked having background information on the people he dealt with. Since Frigg knows I'll be contacting Ms. Miramar tomorrow morning to deal with the account situation, she thought I'd be interested in seeing it as well."
"Does that mean," B asked, "that as far as Frigg is concerned, you're her new Odin?"
"That's a scary thought."
Stu held up his hand as a second musical alert sounded in his ear.
"Frigg."
"Yes, Mr. Raimi, how can I be of service?"
"I heard an alert. Is the facial rec update complete?"
"Yes," she replied.
"All right, then," Stu continued. "I've loaded some video footage and a separate photo into the thumb drive at CC. Run it through the facial rec program, and let's see if it gets a hit. Please reply via text on one of the wall monitors."
While Stu set about inserting the thumb drive and calling up the video file, a second monitor lit up, and the words, "Very well, Mr. Raimi," appeared in the middle of the screen.
"That's pretty amazing," B said. "Her voice recognition capability goes way beyond anything I would have thought possible."
"Yes, it is," Stu agreed. "Amazing and more than a little disturbing. That's why I turned the audio off. I wanted us to be able to talk without her listening."
In the meantime, Cammy had entered the room without either B or Stu noticing her arrival.
"Without who listening?" she asked.
"Frigg," Stu said.
"So she's up and running?"
"Seems like."
"Is she behaving?"
"So far," Stu answered. "But we'll see."
Cammy walked over to where Stu sat and placed a grocery bag down on the table next to the Macintosh.
"I stopped by your place and brought you a change of clothes. I also brought you this."
She held out a closed fist.
"What is it?"
"A little something I took out of an electrical outlet box in the new computer lab. I know our initial plan was to leave all the surveillance equipment in place for the time being, but I wanted to know what we were up against. I also figured that if one unit went offline and the others didn't, whoever was listening might not be all that concerned."
The item Cammy handed over was a metal disc no larger than a nickel. Holding it in his open palm, Stu squinted down at it.
"Something's engraved on the surface, but it's too small for me to read."
"You wouldn't be able to read it even if the printing was big enough," Cammy told him. "It's written in Chinese. I had to borrow a pair of Shirley's reading glasses to make it out. The top line is the name of the company, Spy Toys. The second line is the model, 007. The third line is a serial number. I looked Spy Toys up before I came here. The company is based in Chengdu, and specializes in second-tier surveillance equipment. The first-rate stuff comes from Israel. This is more the bargain basement variety.
Audio only? Stu asked.
That one for sure is audio only, Cammy answered. Because it's tapped into the wiring with no batteries needed, the devices can be smaller and easier to conceal. It's probably a big seller with soon-to-be former wives looking to get the goods on soon-to-be former husbands. I was hoping we'd be able to reach out to the company and locate a point of sale, or maybe even an end user, but that's not going to work. Most of Spy Toys' business is conducted over the dark web.
It figures, Stu muttered.
Don't sound so glum, Cammy told him. I did something else while I was at the office, something you're going to like. I sent a message via those remaining listening devices.
What kind of message?
Remember when we talked earlier about trying to coax whoever's gunning for you and Frigg out into the open? I decided it was time to give that a try, so while I was in the computer lab, I made a big show of talking on the phone. Of pretending to talk on the phone, that is. I acted like I was talking to my dad. I said that you had unexpectedly come into possession of a major piece of intellectual property, a functioning AI, and I asked him how much he thought it would be worth if you auctioned it off in the open market.
Did you and your make-believe dad happen to settle on a price? Stu asked.
Actually, we did, Cammy replied with a grin. I said you should open the bidding wars at $4 million, not counting hardware, and go from there.
You may have been kidding around, B said, but if Stu does decide to unload Frigg, asking $4 million for starters probably isn't all that off the mark. Crap, Stu said. More money? Between Friday morning and now, I've turned into a multimillionaire. On paper, at least.
This can't be happening. While they were all pondering that bit of news, the image of an Arizona driver's license popped up on one of the monitors, drawing everyone's eyes to a newly activated screen. Cammy was the first one to make the connection. Wait, she said. Isn't that him? The guy who's on our security video?
It sure as hell looks like it, Stu said, reading off the screen. Ronald Dawson Webster of West Lambert Lane, Marana, Arizona.
Where's that information coming from? Cammy asked.
From the state's facial rec program.
So your friend Jeff let you in?
Oddly enough, Jeff still hasn't called me back. This is all Frigg's doing.
Wait, Cammy said in disbelief. You're telling me the AI was able to hack into that? I thought that software was super secure.
I'm pretty sure Jeff Swanson thinks so, too.
Frigg's next words appeared on one of the other monitors. Will there be anything else? She asked.
Yes, Stu answered, typing his reply on the CC keyboard. Please do a complete background check on Ronald Dawson Webster.
The individual I located in the facial recognition database?
Yes, Stu said. That's the one.
Of course, Mr. Raimi, Frigg replied. I'll do so at once. Chapter 38. When Allie awakened, she had no idea how long she'd been out. The chaise next to hers, the one where Bee had been sleeping earlier, was empty now. Outside the window, twilight was falling over Sedona's distant red rocks. It may have been evening for everyone else, but according to Allie's interior clock, it felt more like morning. As she rose and stumbled away from her makeshift cot, she realized that although the chaise may have functioned adequately as far as sleeping was concerned, it was definitely not okay for her back. Out from under the covers, she was shocked by how cold the room was. Retrieving a blanket, she wrapped that around her shoulders as she made her way into the bathroom. She was standing at the sink and splashing water on her face when her cell phone rang. The phone was on the counter next to the sink, and when she saw Dave Holman's name in the caller ID window, she picked it up.
Hello?
What the hell have you gotten yourself into this time? He demanded abruptly.
Good afternoon to you, too, she said. Or should I say good evening?
There's nothing good about it. I just got off the phone with a Detective Genevieve Wasser, a homicide cop down in Pima County. She's investigating an arson case that happened overnight in Marana.
What does that arson case down in Marana have to do with me? Allie asked.
Remember that guy whose fingerprint you passed along to Deputy Harper?
Yes, Allie answered. What about him?
His name's Ronald Dawson Webster, and he's dead as a doornail. In the wee hours of the morning, right around 2 a.m., somebody riding a speeding Harley rolled some kind of incendiary device under the floorboards of his motorhome and blew the poor guy to kingdom come. That initial blast was followed by a couple more. Not only was Webster's RV completely destroyed, his parents' garage was burned to the ground right along with their double wide. The whole place is a complete loss.
Okay, Allie said. I get it. This Webster guy is dead, but why are you coming after me? Yesterday you gave me the brush off about investigating that possible intrusion at the office. I believe you said something about my overreacting. Now because he's turned up dead? You automatically leap to the conclusion that I must have had something to do with it? How could I, for one thing? I didn't know who the hell he was. For another, I spent most of last night shuttling back and forth between Cottonwood and Sedona. Marana's, what, 200 miles from here? So unless I've somehow managed to defeat the laws of physics, I couldn't very well be here and in Marana setting fire to an RV at the same time. Her sarcastic response must have gotten Dave's attention. He backed off some, and when he spoke again, his tone was a bit more conciliatory.
It's not that I thought you were responsible, but this is serious, Allie. This Webster character is dead. But the real problem is this. The way he died leads back to some very dangerous people. So what's his connection to High Noon? Do you have any idea what he was doing there?
Planting surveillance devices of some kind, Allie answered.
Why would he be doing that? And who was he working for? Dave wanted to know.
Since he's dead, we obviously can't ask him either one of those questions, Allie replied. But I believe it's safe to assume that he was spying on us.
For whom?
Again, I have no idea.
You didn't mention anything about listening devices when we talked yesterday.
That's because we learned about them after I talked to you, rather than before. It turns out that without my knowledge, Stu and Cammy had installed an interior security monitoring system inside our building. The cameras were up and running on Friday afternoon at the same time that Steve Barris, a.k.a. Ron Webster, was there doing his thing. The problem is, we didn't get a look at the feed until much later in the day yesterday.
You're saying you have video footage of the guy?
Yes, he appeared to be tinkering with various electrical outlets and switch plates. Our assumption is that he was installing some kind of surveillance equipment.
You just called it an assumption. Does that mean you don't know for sure?
We've had several things on our plate. Cammy and Stu have both been out of town this weekend. With everything else that's been going on, and since no one was in over the weekend, we decided to leave the equipment in place until tomorrow, when people are back in the office.
I'd like to get a look at that security video, Dave said. Can you send me a copy? That way I can pass it along to Detective Wasser.
I won't be sending it personally, Allie said. And you'll have it, but only on one condition.
What's that?
You said the homicide leads back to some very dangerous people. What kind of dangerous people?
Dave sighed.
Allie, this is an active investigation. I shouldn't be talking about it with you. It happens to be an active investigation that involves High Noon, and we're the ones who brought it to you in the first place, she insisted. So tell me.
We may be talking about a Mexican drug cartel. Lately, one that operates out of Sinaloa has been suspected of outsourcing their U.S.-based hits to a network of MS-13 gangbangers. So far, there are four separate homicides with M.O.s similar to this one, three in Texas and one in New Mexico. In each of those instances, bottles of gasoline were used to create firebombs that were thrown from speeding motorcycles.
The fire investigation in Marana isn't complete by any means, but they're saying that what they found so far points in the same direction. Back to the cartel.
So you're saying that after Webster targeted High Noon, someone else targeted him?
Exactly, Dave said. And the next question is this. If the drug cartel was out to get him, what are the chances some of the same people aren't going to come looking for you?
No chance, Allie answered firmly. As in zero. To my knowledge, High Noon Enterprises has had no dealings with drug cartels of any kind, Mexican or otherwise. I'll be glad to send along the security video, but I can't see what any of this has to do with us.
No sooner had Allie said the words aloud than she knew they weren't true. Several years earlier, High Noon had been caught in the crossfire between two warring cartels, the Cabrillo Cartel out of Monterrey, Mexico, and the Diaz Cartel from the border town of Juarez. Both had been targeting Lance Tucker's Ghost software, which had ended up providing law enforcement with enough critical information to bring down both organizations. As far as Allie knew, neither of them had survived. All of that was in the distant past, but could what was happening now harken back to any of that?
I hope you're right about that, Dave was saying. In the meantime, you need to know that I've already given your contact information to Detective Wasser. I'm sure she'll be in touch, and I wouldn't be surprised if ATF turned up on your doorstep as well.
They've all called in the feds? Allie asked.
In the past 2 weeks, because of those other four cases, the ATF sent notices to agencies all along the Mexican border, warning them to be on the lookout for this kind of activity. Someone in Pima County picked up on the similarity almost immediately, and the sheriff asked for help.
Dave paused. Then, seeming to notice Allie's stricken silence, he asked,
"Are you still there?"
"I'm here," she answered. "Just trying to wrap my head around all this."
"I know," he said. "It's a lot to take in, but whatever's going on, it's dangerous as hell, Allie, and you and everyone else at High Noon need to act accordingly."
"Will do," Allie said. "Thanks for the heads up, Dave. I've got to run."
And run she did. Bounding out of the bathroom, Allie paused only long enough to slip on her shoes before dashing through the makeshift master bedroom, down the hall, and out through the kitchen. Alonzo was there, loading dishes into the dishwasher, but Allie raced past him, making for the stairway that led to the man cave off the garage.
"I know who Steve Barris really is," she announced as she burst into the room.
"So do we,"
B replied, motioning up to where the image of Ronald Dawson Webster's Arizona driver's license was displayed on an overhead screen.
"Frigg just told us."
"Who told you?"
"Dave Holman," Allie answered.
"Dave?" B asked. "How did that happen? What's he got to do with any of this?"
"After you went to sleep earlier, I stopped by the substation hoping to talk to Dave and ask him to run the print I lifted off the buzzer. He wasn't there, but the deputy who was on duty agreed to run the print anyway. She did, and it came back with a hit to this guy, to Ronald Webster. And now he's dead."
"Webster is dead?"
"He was murdered last night down in Marana. He was asleep inside a motorhome when someone used an improvised bomb of some kind to blow the whole thing sky high, burning down his parents' garage and home in the process. He was pronounced dead at the scene. I promised Dave that we'd send him our security footage so he could pass it along to Detective Wasser, the homicide cop handling the case."
For a moment, the only sound in the room was the steady hum of the laboring AC as everyone internalized that bit of information. B was the first to speak.
"You want me to send the footage to Dave?"
"Please," Allie said.
"Okay," B said, keying in the numbers. "But are you saying that, with Webster dead, High Noon's name is probably going to surface in the course of the homicide investigation?"
Allie nodded miserably. "That's the size of it," she said, "and it's all my fault. In fact, it's even worse than that."
"How could it possibly be worse?"
The way Webster was killed, that particular brand of arson homicide is a signature M.O. that's known to law enforcement. According to David, suggests that the perpetrator may be a member of the MS-13 doing dirty work for one of the Mexican drug cartels.